It's pitch black. There's water everywhere, rock overhead. You don't know where you are, how to get out, or if anyone is even trying to find you.
Thank you.
Thank you. How many of you? 13. Brilliant. Many people are coming.
The plight of 12 boys and their coach trapped in a flooded cave in Thailand transfixed the world for 18 days last June. Of course it did. It's nightmare fuel. Nobody could look away. Every detail fed to the horde of international media that gathered outside the cave became fodder for daily reports or nightly newscasts.
Tonight, rescue teams in Thailand are working around the clock, scrambling to free...
There have been no contact with the boys who are aged between 11 and 16.
The world, as it turns out, had come to help.
They are pumping water furiously from the cave, hundreds of thousands...
But there were some details that never made it to the gathered press and some perspective that only time can bring. So what didn't we know last year when we thought we'd heard everything? Who were the people who made up the team that attempted to do the impossible? How precarious was the survival of these boys? What didn't we understand at the time that we do now? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is part one of a special two-episode Big Story, taking you inside one of the great rescue missions in the history of the world.
Many of them were told, you know, if you want to do this, you need to be prepared to be bringing out dead bodies. This is probably going to be a recovery mission, not a rescue mission.
Shannon Gormley is a freelance writer who was on location at the cave during the rescue and then spent months afterwards sitting down in person with everyone who made it happen for an exhaustive feature in Maclean's.
Explain to me what's changed about the story of the Thai boys in the cave and the rescue that captivated the world, because things are different now than they are at the time it was reported.
I think at the time, as we tend to do, we trusted experts to know what to do best. We thought that, you know, the experts were in charge, and we didn't know that they would be able to save the boys. But I don't think the world had a good sense of the fact that there are no experts in this situation. This has never happened before. We've never had 12 children trapped in a flooded cave. There are certainly expert cave divers, and there are people who specialize in rescues, but not of this type. And so I think, and unfortunately, I think as the story has progressed, that sense of inevitability of the success of the rescue has almost become cemented in our minds.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that the more you talk to divers, the more you realize, truly, they all thought that most, if not all, of the children were going to die.
Take us back there to where it started. How did the boys end up in the cave?
The boys were exploring, as they often do. So they had just come back from soccer practice. They were on their bikes. They ended up at this cave, and they thought, let's go and have a look inside. When they entered the cave, there was a sign warning saying, you know, rainy season is coming, so don't enter. But it wasn't raining then, so they thought it was safe. They got into the cave. They got deeper into the cave, a little deeper. And by the time they were past the point of no return, it was raining, and they were so deep inside they couldn't hear the rain. And the cave filled up with water, and they were trapped.
Oh, my God. Even when you just say it now, and it takes me back to learning about this story, it's just so terrifying. Like, it's just viscerally terrifying.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think there are a lot of elements that are, as you say, very visceral for us. They're in the dark. Mm-hmm. They have very little access to light. As it turned out, they had some headlights, I think, from their bikes. But basically in the dark, no food, and surrounded by water, and they ended up on a tiny little patch of land. So, you know, it's difficult to imagine a more terrifying situation.
Tell me what had to be done as soon as they realized that these boys were trapped in the cave, and what had to be mobilized?
Well, first of all, they had to find the boys. And that was hard enough because they had a good idea of where they were going to be, but they didn't know for certain. And the Thai Navy SEALs were extremely brave and went into the cave under the worst possible conditions. But unfortunately, they weren't trained for this kind of diving. They're trained for open water diving, and cave diving is a very different animal. And so one of the things that they needed were experts. And when the experts came in, the Thai Navy SEALs were trying to lay the line. And laying the line is a guideline that cave divers can follow in the dark or through currents or just something to let them know where they're going.
To
take them to the boys. Well, they were laying the line to where they believed the boys were. They hadn't found them yet. That was the most important thing. They laid the line, then they found the boys. Then it was a matter of getting them out.
Who found the boys?
Two Brits named Rick Stanton and John Valantham.
You covered the story on the ground as it was happening, and you've also put together an exhaustive retrospective, I guess, look at what really happened as opposed to what we kind of knew as it was going on.
Yeah.
What was it like to stand outside that cave when the boys were inside and the whole world was watching them?
When I think back to my time reporting on the rescue attempt and just prior to the rescue attempt, I think of my life as being bifurcated. There are two parts. There was the part immediately outside the cave where, in a sense, believe it or not, you're almost not aware of the stakes because you're just in the midst of a flurry of activity.
Right.
So really what I was focused on was this bizarre little world that had crept up outside of the cave because journalists weren't allowed inside. So all we saw was this hub of activity of volunteers.
So, what was that world like? Well, describe it.
It's so cheesy to say, but I've really never seen a country come together the way they did here. People flew in from all over Thailand, including from Bangkok, just to serve food or scrub toilets or pick up garbage or give free haircuts. All for the rescuers. There were thousands of people there at the cave, and that's something that I will never forget. And so when I was outside the cave, it's almost strange because the closer I was to the cave, the more easy it was to forget that really we were all here to save 12 boys and their soccer coach. When I left the cave and I was alone in my hotel room at night, that's when it always hit me. And it felt pretty impossible. And one of the reasons I think it felt particularly impossible to me was that I'd met a rescuer, and I won't be able to forget this look on his face. And I describe it as grim in the piece, but that doesn't quite capture it. He just seemed quite, this combination of determination and heavy-heartedness. I was on a shuttle bus taking me to the region where the cave was.
This is as you were coming in to start
reporting.
That's
right. Yes, that's right. So I was coming in to start reporting, and I was preparing to go into this region, and there was a blonde man on the shuttle bus, and we looked at each other, and I think that we were the only foreigners on the bus. I started talking to him, and it turned out he was one of the rescuers. And as I say, he just seemed very grim, and it was difficult for me to get that out of my mind in the quieter hours, because it was a heavy enough grimness that it seemed like, well, it just seemed like death was in the air. It did not seem like this was a rescue that was going to go well.
There were such a cast of characters that you reported on and wrote about and who saved these boys.
Yeah.
Who are these people? What are they like?
Well, I'll never forget them. Is it partly because it's such a mix of people?
Yeah.
We can talk a little bit about what makes them the same, but on the surface at least, they could not be more different. You know, you have people that are former surfers, mixed with military men, mixed with doctors, mixed with firefighters. What makes them all the same is that they're all explorers at heart. They're drawn to the danger of the cave. It's a place that most people don't go. Cave diving, it's hard to think of a hobby that could threaten your life quite as much as this one. But that's what they like about it, the fact that most men don't do this, and that means that there are things to find that haven't been found before.
And they'd all sort of just heard when the news reports broke, and they were among those thousands of people that came.
Yes, that's right. You know, they often call themselves a community. So this is where Facebook comes in handy for them. They're all on these Facebook groups together. So one of their friends would be at the cave, and then they would say, "Do you need more people?" And they'd say, "Yes, we do. Come on over." So that's how many of them arrived at the cave.
What faced them? I mean, especially now that we can look back and have more depth of knowledge of what was actually going on and required.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult was the situation, and what obstacles were in the way?
It was an impossible situation. The more you learn about it, the less clear it is how it worked. So in terms of the situation itself, the boys were 3 kilometers inside a mostly flooded cave, and they were up against the water because the boys couldn't dive. They were up against zero visibility.
Right.
You could barely see your own hand, and this is even if you had a headlamp attached to your helmet. There were incredibly tight restrictions, tight enough that some of the divers had a hard time getting through and got stuck a couple of times. And for a time at least, although this changed depending on how well the pumps were working, there were really terrible currents. So all of those things combined meant that it was very unlikely that the boys were going to get out alive.
What was happening around the cave as the community, I guess, was trying to decide on how to try to get them out? Like, what was the, was there a sense of positivity? Was there?
Oddly, yes.
Yeah.
So this, again, is where my experience as a journalist in outside of the cave was very different than what was happening inside the cave.
Right.
Outside the cave, you're confronted with this eternal optimism of, and it almost seemed insane optimism of Thai people, which became quite infectious. They really believed, they completely trusted that the boys were going to live. Now, that's not to say that they weren't worried, but to deal with the worry, they were making a lot of offerings and they were coming together thinking that this would help the boys survive. And actually, there's a lot of truth to that. The volunteerism had some real effects. But inside the cave, as I say, the rescuers themselves were pretty pessimistic. Many of them were told, you know, if you want to do this, you need to be prepared to be bringing out dead bodies. This is probably going to be a recovery mission, not a rescue mission.
So tell me about the mission itself then. How many options did they have? Like, what could they do to get these kids out? I think the world knows they kind of put them under and brought them out.
Mm-hmm. They had a few options, and they were all pretty terrible. So one option that really was gaining steam as I arrived at the cave was just leave the boys in. Let it dry out, you know, have Navy SEALs bring in food and supplies and let them live on this tiny little patch of land. And I thought that was the best idea at the time, but I know nothing about this.
Yeah.
And most people know nothing about how to do this, but that's what so-called experts were recommending.
How long would that have taken?
Well, that would have taken probably at least 4 months for it to dry out. And in the meantime, the boys would have been at extremely high risk of infection. And they also would have been living in the dark in a cave, and you know what that does to your psyche. It would have been a terrible option, both in terms of the physical effects on the boys, as well as the mental suffering that it would cause. So that was done away with. They decided they can't do that. There was also an option of looking for a natural chimney, and many teams went searching over the mountain for this chimney that they thought might exist. And the reason they thought that a chimney might exist is because some of the boys reported hearing roosters crowing and other related sorts of sounds. So they thought, well, maybe there is some kind of natural opening through the cave that we can get the boys through. But they never found anything like that. Mm. And it's very likely that, in fact, the boys were hallucinating. And in fact, some divers told me that they themselves, just stuck for 20 or 30 minutes on their own, started experiencing hallucinations. This is an environment that most of us can barely even imagine, but you're completely alone and you're listening to the sounds of bubbles all around you and you start to lose your mind a little bit. Then there was the option of drilling a chimney, and that was also not viable for a couple of reasons. First of all, they'd have to drill through 700 to 800 meters of rock, so that takes time and it could cause some kind of destabilization.
That one seems kind of insane.
And that left the fourth option, which was the most insane of them all, but really the most viable one, which was dive these children out one by one.
How would that have worked?
The only way it could have worked was by sedating them completely. And that's because if these children were awake, they would have panicked. And if they panicked, they would have drowned the rescuers and therefore themselves. So there was, through the most bizarre kind of luck that I can really imagine, there is a top-notch cave diver who also happens to be an anesthesiologist, and his name is Dr. Harry. It's bizarre to me that this person happens to exist at this time. We have a cave diving anesthesiologist, because if it weren't for him, all the divers that I've spoken to have agreed that this mission simply wouldn't have been possible. They might not have even attempted it, and it certainly wouldn't have been successful. He is an Australian. As I say, he's an anesthesiologist. And I think something that may be almost as important is that he has a way of drawing people together. So he's a very low-key, humble, nice, funny guy. And in a time of tension like this, I heard over and over from divers how valuable that was. He instilled a sense of calm, if not confidence, in people so that they were able to do their job. Well, the results speak for themselves.
How come we didn't know at the time what option four really was?
I've heard different answers to that. One answer is that they didn't want the parents to worry that the children were going to be sedated. Another answer is that they were sedated with ketamine, and that has some negative connotations and uses. A third answer is it was going to be a distraction. You know, they thought that the focus of media attention was suddenly going to be on the drugs. The lead divers knew that the only way this would work was if the kids were sedated. But if there was a lot of media attention and some of that went negative, they could hurt the chances of the mission.
It is really astounding to me how the story of what was actually happening in that cave can be so different than, because this story was everywhere. Every single news organization in the world had a truck here.
That's right. Yeah. Had a truck. Plus me.
Plus you.
Plus I was alone.
Just hanging out in a hotel and standing by the cave.
That's right. Well, everything happened so quickly. You know, there were at the time, a lot of things were misreported, but I don't think that was for lack of trying or due diligence from the reporters. I think that it was mayhem. And I actually think one thing that they did really well, from my perspective, I thought that the authorities struck a good balance between letting the media come close enough that the world would know, would have some idea of what was happening. And when it was clear that a lot of media attention might start to become a distraction, pushing us back more and more. So I thought that the balance was pretty good.
What did all the divers tell you about the discussion around all the options that they had and how they felt about option four?
Nobody felt good about option four, but almost everybody thought that that was the right choice. There was one diver I spoke to who in the beginning thought that that was a really bad choice, but he also knew that at that point the mission was underway and he could either participate or not. And he decided he wanted to help, and he did. So I think that's pretty remarkable in and of itself.
And all through this, some divers are leaving and some divers are arriving. And there's this whole team working on it.
Yes. The teamwork dynamics are pretty inspiring to me. Because
tell me about the inside of that team, because you spoke to like everybody on it.
Well, I didn't speak to everybody on it, but I sure spoke to many of them. And what was striking is that many of them had to work together, never having met before. And that's a really difficult thing to do. Teamwork is hard enough, challenging enough, when you have a history with people. When you don't have a history with them, it becomes much more difficult. But they, you know, in the end, they were able to overcome this feeling of, well, I don't know that I know you, so how is this going to work? They were able to overcome that and do something that, you know, is unimaginable. Even though it's happened, it's unimaginable.
Dr. Harry aside, who are some of the other personalities on the team that you really will never forget?
All of them.
Yeah.
I won't forget any of them because, as you say, they're just such characters and they accomplished something so remarkable. There was Jim, who is, all these men are very talented, but I don't think he would normally be named as one of the top cave divers in the world. And he had a remarkable experience where he started off as a support diver and ended up being a lead. And that in and of itself, I think, takes a lot of courage. You know, he was scared. So, you know, not bravery. It's not as if he wasn't able to feel the fear, but he pushed past it. And I have a lot of admiration for that. And I have a lot of admiration for Eric Brown, who clearly is not in, he's from Canada, and he's clearly not in this for the spotlight. So the idea of humility was really important to him. And that's something that I'll take away from the cave. And I noticed that in Dr. Harry as well. Yeah, they're also different, but there are a few that stick out, certainly.
What kind of preparations were being made before they went in to actually try to get these boys out? What did they do in advance? What did that practice look like?
Well, they had to do a few things. First of all, the cave itself was full of tangled wires at a certain point because they had to bring certain things in quite quickly. So cleaning up the wires was really important. They had to dive supplies in, so they were making supply runs into the boys to deliver food, right, as well as dive suits. And maybe the most important task that they had to accomplish was laying tanks. So they would clip tanks to the guideline so that they'd be able to breathe. Because one of the most dangerous parts about cave diving is that if you run out of oxygen, there's nowhere to go. You can't rise to the surface usually because you've got a ceiling locking you in. So laying tanks was really critical.
And how would they practice for taking the boys out themselves? How would they prepare to do that?
This was one of the most interesting things I heard about. They had what was called a rock drill. So normally, from my understanding is that if you're planning some kind of military attack, you might lay rocks and sticks in the ground to map out your line of attack. And that's what they did in a parking lot. They used water bottles and police tape to make some kind of mock-up of the cave almost, and they would do a, they did an actual walkthrough. This is where these tanks are going to be placed. This is where these divers need to be. This is where the children are. This is how we're going to get them out.
What was the atmosphere like leading up to when they actually went in for the final mission?
It would depend on the diver. So here's where personality differences come into play. Some divers were really terrified and had a hard time sleeping at night, and other divers have a very directed sense of purpose and were very calm about it and decided to look at this, I think, purposefully as just any other mission. This time they're just bringing something out with them. So there were some personality differences that came out there. They weren't looking at this as just any other mission out of a lack of humanity. Mm-hmm. It was purposeful so that they'd be able to do their jobs better. And many of them do have, particularly the Brits, they do come from a cave rescue background. But it's very, very rare that they're able to rescue people. Usually, if someone gets stuck in a cave, they die. And almost always, the person who gets stuck in a cave is a cave diver. So they have experience. Sedating someone and dragging them out, as far as I know, has never been done, and certainly it's never been done with a child.
That was The Big Story, part one of a special two-part episode. When Shannon returns tomorrow, we'll talk about the rescue itself and what came afterwards.
And every time there was a success and a boy was brought out alive, that didn't diminish the risks for the next boy. Every single boy's life was at serious risk. Every single boy was probably going to die.
For more from us, you can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca or at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can also find us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn and at frequencypods. And of course, we are wherever you get podcasts, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify. Have a listen, give us a rating, give us a review. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. Part two tomorrow.